Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're here to talk about the issues that can empower people, that can give people an opportunity to go forward in their life, to have as much control over the choices they make as possible. Hence, it is an empowering hour. Today, for example, we'll be talking about major depression improved with a sea vegetable. I'll also talk about high blood sugar inhibits positive effects of exercise on bone health, and this is from the University of Delaware. I'll also include information about chestnut leaves yielding an extract that disarms deadly staph bacteria. This is from Emory University. Much more. From our environmental segment, think California's drought is bad? Yeah, it is. Try Palestine's. While Israelis water their lawns and swim in Olympic-sized pools, Palestinians, well, they're just a few kilometers away, and they're literally dying of thirst. From Laith Shakir, Foreign Policy in Focus. Also, today we're going to share some positive insight on what we can do to slow or curb climate change. And it's cheap, not difficult. I'll give you that insight as we go on with the program. Also, a commentary today, the raping of America, mile markers on the road to fascism, Professor John Whitehead from Op-Ed News. My guest in the second part of our program, Professor Francis Boyle, Changing the Rules of Modern War, the Pentagon's recent Law of War manual. Well, it is something. Wow. If only you knew what they're now allowing in war. Things that were outlawed by the Geneva Convention, by the Nuremberg laws. And we have wiped all that away. Well, Professor Boyle has served on the board of directors of Amnesty International and the Council for Responsible Genetics. He is one of America's leading law professors. He's a professor of international law at University of Illinois Law School. He has a long career as an anti-war activist and upholder of human rights. So we'll talk with him at length. Also, for those of you who are not aware of some of the current scandals going on, I'll bring you up to date on the Forex, F-O-R-E-X scandal. Now, mind you, these are white-collar criminals. They have already paid $9 billion, that's with a B, dollars, in a fine, and they're as happy as can be. We're talking about RBS, Barclays, HSBC, and Goldman Sachs were among nine global banks that agreed to one settlement of $2 billion, but then additional settlements as well. What was their penalty? Were they disgraced? Were they sent to jail? Not at all. In fact, they didn't even have to give back their ill-gotten gains for trading on insider information and manipulating the markets. They rigged the foreign exchange, that's the Forex, and they got away with it. Oh, the fact that they got caught and had to pay a fine is meaningless. It's the cost of doing business. So I've got a solution for that. Now, here's a question for you. Recently, I had a chance in an airport to speak with a person, and we discussed the issue of what would be a way for the worlds that are at war to come together and find peaceful solutions. And one of the comments the person made was, well, they haven't suffered, but we suffered. I said, who hasn't suffered? He said, the Muslims haven't suffered. I said, really? Okay. So I went about explaining how many Muslims, minimally, we know have died because of the U.S. intervention in the Middle East in just the last 15 years. What would you guess the number to be? Now, mind you, this is a low, low figure. The actual figure is much higher. How about 4 million? 4 million, that's genocide, and yet we're not even thinking about what that means. Now attach 40 extended members of a family, aunts, uncles, and 40 times 4, that's 160 million people, you've really gotten angry at you. There's no way around this. We have to approach things differently. Let's begin. We have a lot to share today. We have a lot of depression in America, but it's not due to a brain chemical imbalance, as you've been led to believe. There are legitimate reasons for feeling down or depressed. The end of relationships, the loss of a loved one, a pet, downsizing, loss of a job, fear of losing your home or losing your home, people acting out in ways that you would never hope they would, but they do, and ill health. Those are just some of the reasons. But the fact that you're depressed about something doesn't mean that you are forever depressed. Doesn't mean you need medication for it. So we are an over-medicated society. In fact, 25% of all women between 25 and 45 are on some form of antidepressant or anti-anxiety medication. Is there another way? Yes, there is. I believe that we should see a return to humanistic psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, where you have a chance to speak with a person and explain what you feel maybe the causes of your maladies, who could have some experience opening up the picture, making it broader, giving you different ways of approaching it without medication or institutionalization. There's also nutrition. I did a PBS special years ago. It was called The Food Mood Connection, showing the relationship between food and mood. And indeed, we can show how sugar can cause a person to become very depressed or very anxious, but also things that we're allergic to. I've counseled people who thought their children would be forever ADHD, but they were on a junk food diet, high in caffeine and processed sugars. Took them off the bad diet, put them on a clean, healthy living foods diet, suddenly the symptoms went away. We're talking about millions of people. But now there's one other piece to the puzzle. According to the latest research, it is chlorella. Chlorella, C-H-L-O-R-E-L-L-A. That is a seaweed. It is an algae. And according to the University of Western Australia in Perth, they have found that chlorella has significantly improved symptoms of depression. Researchers divided the individuals into two separate groups. They gave half the group 1,800 milligrams, that's 1.8 grams, of chlorella vulgaris every day, and the other they gave standard care. The researchers used the scale, what is called the Hospital Anxiety and Depression Scale, to test the patient's symptoms of depression, along with the Beck Depression Inventory 2 scale. Both of these have been used in clinical settings to establish the range of depressive symptoms and the severity of the diagnosis. After just 6 weeks of either using the standard pharmaceutical treatment or chlorella, the researchers found those patients who had taken the chlorella had, quote, significantly reduced scores in both depression tests. In fact, it went down almost 4 points, which is substantial. To give some reference, the HADS scale consists of 21 points, and anything over 8 is considered symptomatic of depression, and it went down below that. In addition to reduced test scores, the researchers also saw significant reductions in some of the subset scores. For example, physical and cognitive symptoms were significantly improved in the chlorella group, and that is substantial. Quote from the study: "This pilot exploratory trial provides the first clinical evidence on the efficacy and safety of adjunctive therapy with chlorella in improving physical and cognitive symptoms of depression as well as anxiety symptoms in patients who receive standard antidepressant therapy," end quote. So again, chlorella, C-H-L-O-R-E-L-L-A, is a microalgae. It is a single-celled algae. It's grown in tanks, so it's controlled for purity. It is really high in protein, over 40% protein. And it has all the 8 essential amino acids. And it stimulates growth hormone and brain neurotransmitters. And it's one of the great detoxification nutrients also. In fact, when helping people detoxify and cleanse and rebalance their biochemistry, I always recommend two microalgaes, spirulina, which has even more protein, and chlorella together. And then add in some ginger juice. And if you take a teaspoon of chlorella, a teaspoon of spirulina, 2 ounces of ginger juice, 4 ounces of lemon juice, and you put all that into about 28 ounces of water, and you drink that throughout the day, you're doing your body a tremendous service. It also naturally chelates out and toxins. Now, we know that high blood sugar is bad. And we know that a lot of people wake up every morning, probably close to 100 million known and pre-diabetics. And their blood sugars can be anywhere from 110 to 180. That's diabetic, and that's dangerous. That increases the likelihood of heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, depression, and neuropathies. So you kill yourself when your blood sugar's high. From the University of Delaware, quote, diabetes, which now affects 30 million Americans, can cause serious health complications, including heart disease, blindness, kidney failure, and low extremity amputations. Oh, by the way, as an aside, to the gentleman who came to the retreat with his wife, who showed me the cell phone of when he was in the hospital very recently, and with a huge opening on his foot, and they were recommending amputation. And he tried the protocol, and now his foot is healed, saved the foot. Would you please go back to the doctor, get the doctor to re-examine, show them the current foot, take a picture, the foot when you were in the hospital, and then ask the doctor how many amputations that hospital does for similar situations, and would he be interested in knowing the protocol that you used that saved your foot from being amputated? I'd like to see his response. In any case, the 30 million are diagnosed diabetics. There's the 60 million who are undiagnosed. Now, what we know is this. A lesser known but equally grave complication of diabetes is bone health. Quote, clinical trials have revealed a startling elevation in fracture risk in diabetic patients. This is according to Professor of Mechanical Engineering, University of Delaware. Quote, bone fractures can be life-threatening. Nearly 1 in 6 hip fracture patient dies within a year of injury. And because physical exercise is proven to improve bone properties and reduce bone fractures in non-diabetic people, they wanted to see would this also be true for diabetes. And what they found was that high blood sugar inhibits the positive effects of exercise on bone health with diabetes. So this is the takeaway message. Exercise every day. I suggest low-impact exercise if you're diabetic for a simple reason. You don't want to get a lesion. You don't want to get a blister because you may not feel it. When you have neuropathy, you frequently do not feel a little cut. You could puncture the skin. You wouldn't know it. Then in comes an infection because of poor circulation and swelling in the tissue. Amputations are epidemic in our society, absolutely epidemic. But if you begin exercising and gradually increase it up to an hour a day, start slow and graduate up in time and distance and duration, then you increase microcirculation. Now, if you take the tocotrienols, which are subfractions of the tocopherols, the vitamin E, and if you took 400 units before you exercised and 400 units after you exercised, and if you took vitamin C 1,000 milligrams buffered before you exercised and 1,000 milligrams after you exercised, if you took 200 units of milligrams of coenzyme Q10 before and 200 after, if you took magnesium 600 milligrams before and 600 milligrams after, and cayenne at a high heat index before and after, what you're doing, you're stimulating microcirculation into the extremities. You're helping your feet. You're also helping your brain, by the way. And you're lessening opportunity for stroke because you're keeping the blood thin and oxygenated. So if some of you want to know why, when you were exercising, thinking you were going to strengthen your bones and you didn't, it's because diabetes will weaken the bones and exercise by itself will not be enough. And also, we have a very deadly bacteria. It's called Staph, S-T-A-P-H. According to Emory University, as published in PLOS One, this Staphylococcus aureus, is very virulent, and the pathogenesis is makes it very difficult to treat. Quote, we've identified a family of compounds from this plant that have an interesting medical mechanism. Rather than killing Staph, this botanical extract works by taking away Staph's weapons, essentially shutting off the ability of the bacteria to create toxins that cause tissue damage. In other words, it takes the teeth out of the bacteria's bite. What exactly is this? It's causing 23,000 deaths a year, at least 2 million infections a year. What will stop it? Chestnut leaves. You heard me right. Chest, C-H-E-S-T, nut, N-U-T, leaves. You can get an extract of chestnut leaf extract from any health food store. So that's important to use. And that's from Emory University. And also one last thing, low vitamin D is tied to dry eye syndrome. So if you have dry eyes, according to the International Journal of Rheumatic Diseases, could be due to vitamin D deficiency. A lot of people are not getting their vitamin D. Get your vitamin D. In Columbia University, a new study, depression definitely linked to refined carbohydrates. Quote, psychological health is deeply affected by physiological choices. One more reason to, quote, think before you eat. Could the bout of the blues you're dealing with be possibly linked to the pasta you had for last night's dinner? According to new research, absolutely. And while the importance of consuming wholesome, unprocessed foods has almost become common knowledge in recent years, the average American diet is still predominantly 70% made up of processed junk. And according to a recent study conducted by Columbia University and published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, there is a, quote, clear link between consumption of refined carbohydrates and sugar and depression. The researchers stated, quote, any influence that refined carbohydrates has on mood could be commensurate, meaning corresponding to size or degree, with their proportion in the overall diet. So when you have your bagel, your donut, your toast, any of the white flour products, you are possibly contributing to depression. I'm Gary Nall. That's our health segment for our program. Now I want to share something from our environment. This comes from Nadia Prubas from Common Dreams. Quote, cutting tropical deforestation is key to curbing climate change, and it's cheap. New studies show how easy it is to curb one driving force of climate change and the devastating consequences if we don't. Without drastic efforts to reduce deforestation, rising greenhouse gases, and unsustainable global agriculture, the planet is on track to lose a massive quantity of its tropical forests, a crucial element in the fight against irreversible climate change. And we must do this within 35 years or it's game over. Absent aggressive conservation policies, the world will lose 2.9 million square kilometers of its tropical forest in the next 35 years. And that's according to the Center for Global Development. So, here's the numbers. Now, think of this for a moment, because I like to put things in terms that you can actually visually appreciate. Business is not going to change this. The governments of no country are going to change it, especially the South American countries like Brazil and Argentina. in Colombia, the United States is not going to change it. We have too many of our legislators who've been bought by the special interest groups, including the Koch brothers. So we have to change this. The carbon emissions that would occur during that process of business as usual is going to get us over 2 degrees Celsius. That adds up to 169 billion tons. That's the equivalent of running 44,000 typical coal plants per year. That's 44,000 plants per year. And so how do we do this? All right, here are my suggestions. Number one, stop drinking coffee. Now, recently at a retreat, I asked a group of people the following question. Do you support women's rights? People look rather surprised. Says, of course we do. I said, do you support that women should not be abused? And again, the answer was, of course, they shouldn't be abused. I said, okay, are you sure? They said, yes. I said, well, I would agree with that. And I'm sure the people in this room do support it. But you can support something ideologically, politically, theoretically, but that doesn't count unless you also support it in a very practical way. Look inside your collar of your shirt, or your blouse. Where's it made? And when two people looked in, it was Bangladesh and China. I said, now, on the one hand, I'm not accusing anyone of being insensitive because we are all susceptible to various programming. But in Bangladesh, there's over 900 million garments made this year just for the United States, from high-end boutiques to and designer stores to low-end, like Walmart, where women worked for 14 cents an hour, frequently 14 to 16 hours a day. And they're frequently beaten with switches if they don't do something fast enough. They have very unsanitary water drinking conditions. They're only allowed 2 breaks to go to the bathroom in a day. And by the time they get home at night, they have to fix the food for their family, do their laundry, prepare their own food, get a few hours sleep, and start over again. And as a result, they have the lowest lifespan at work of any group in the world. And yet, they're invisible. The only time you ever hear of these people is when there's a fire in a building and 100 or 200 or 300 people perish. But nothing changes because Bangladesh is completely, totally, 100% corrupt and will remain corrupt. And everyone knows it. What they do for this little dog and pony routine is we're going to arrest some people and we're going to do something. And in India and, well, every country of the world, unless you know one outside of Iceland, that might be an exception, but all countries are corrupt. The very basis of their body politic makes them corrupt because one group dominant, all others subordinate. And then the favors, the cronyism, and the sense of exceptionalism to staying in office as long as they can and serving their own needs. And then from there, it scoots down the ladder to self-dealing and bribery, etc. And of course, caught in all this is what happens if you're trying to make a product because you have no other source of income, you're not being helped by your government, nor are you being treated fairly, and yet people are profiting, the stockholders are profiting. In fact, even pensions, without ever thinking, are we earning our pension based upon who is being in any way adversely affected in the workplace to make the profits? And the hedge funds shield these people from knowing where their money is actually invested, so they kind of don't want to know that much detail. So I said what we can all do is we can start today to realize, okay, that's a mistake we make. Why don't we try looking for products made in the USA with fair labor or union labor? And it was funny because one of the women there said, show us yours. So I said, you look. My shirt, made in California, and my pants, even pulled out the back of my underwear, show made in USA. So I believe that all it takes is a little awareness. Now, this also should be true for our products. Is your product genetically engineered or not? Are you buying from a local farmer's market? It doesn't have to be certified organic, just as long as you're not using pesticides, most don't, then you're supporting something that helps the farmer, helps society, helps the environment, and helps you in your health. Supporting food co-ops and small health food stores, not the big health food stores, because they're no better than, they're the Goldman Sachs version of the health food industry, something like Whole Foods. And just being conscious of where things are purchased and what went into making them allows us a moment where we can pause and say, is this something that's responsible or something it's not? That gets me to the idea of coffee. Because a lot of people who in other areas of their life are certainly conscientious would not think twice about having some coffee. Well, where's the coffee grown? How's it grown for the majority of coffee? And what people don't realize, but the University of Kansas did a study on this, and here's what they say, quote, the explosion in worldwide coffee consumption in the past two decades has generally not benefited farmers of coffee beans in poorer nations along the equator. University of Kansas researchers studying trade and globalization has found that the shift in technified coffee production in the 1970s and 80s has created harsher economic and ecological consequences for heavy coffee-producing nations such as Honduras, Colombia, Guatemala, Brazil, Vietnam, Ethiopia. Historically, coffee has been exploited by the West in various ways because it's consumed in such rich countries and grown in poor ones. So we in the rich country, we buy coffee, but we exploit people in the poor countries to get it. Now, the study entitled Trading in Crisis, Coffee, Ecological Rift, and Ecological Unequal Exchange was shared at the annual meeting of the American Sociological Association. And so let's just take it further. So what if we stopped buying this coffee unless we knew that it was legitimately fair trade, and we stopped buying chocolate the same for the same reason? And what if we stopped buying palm oil where they're exploiting the indigenous tribes, the environment, causing massive pollution? And what if we stopped buying sugar, all refined sugars, unless it can be shown that it came from fair trade and was not exploitive either to the environment or to the workers? And then what if we stop buying pineapples, like Dole's pineapples and Del Monte pineapples, and the juices from those? Well, just imagine then the bananas, the soybeans. What if we stop buying meat that requires giant areas of the rainforest to be destroyed in order to grow soybeans to feed to the cattle so you can have your cheap hamburger or your steak? Now, not just in the United States, but in India, Brazil, and China, where the need to keep up with America's standard of living, including high consumption of meat, is on everyone's mind. So, if we had a planetary-wide, and mind you, this program is heard almost in every country of the world. So, if those of you listening would take a step and just start with one step, that's all I'm asking, is stop for 1 week, 7 days, have nothing with any processed sugars, any animal proteins at all, the genetically engineered soybeans, coffee, and anything that is grown where tropical forests have to be destroyed, including palm oil. And do it for 1 week. See how you feel. See what changes are made. Now, when we get 10 million people doing that, which we could in within a year, then we've made a difference. And then in its place, move to have planting of trees, which act as carbon sinks, holding the CO2 in the ground and not in the air, and helping to keep from desertification. It would make a step in the right direction, a positive solution. But it all comes down to one person at a time saying, I'm not going to have that anymore. Now, it's interesting because I just had a retreat where some people came and demanded meat. And when I said, you knew this was vegan, they went out to a restaurant to eat. But others said, yes, I've never eaten vegan before. I'm going to try. And because there were gourmet vegan dishes, beautifully prepared and served, they actually had transformative experiences. In fact, I'll be posting more than 50 or 60 positive letters from people who said it changed their life. So once again, let's become aware of what we consume. Where does it come from? And can we make a difference? Could we produce this in America? Could we bring jobs back to America? Could we re-industrialize America? I believe we can. But I don't believe our government will do it on any level, ever. It is too corrupt. I don't believe that major industries are going to do it. It takes individuals with conscious compassion and commitment. Now, another thing, when we talk about the great drought of California, which everyone's in a panic, but very little's being done constructively, and more people are still moving into the state. Just imagine the three states nobody should be moving to, Nevada, Arizona, and California, actually are seeing an increase in population, as if somehow this whole drought thing is just going to go away and this monster El Nino is not going to cause more devastation. Living in denial. Well, I'd like to share a short piece from Laith Shakir from Foreign Policy in Focus. The article's entitled, Think California's Drought is Bad? Try Palestine's. I'll quote, California is in the midst of one of the worst droughts in the state's history, prompting Governor Jerry Brown to declare war a water state of emergency. Ordinary Californians are bearing the brunt of this disaster, and while the governor has imposed restrictions to reduce residential water consumption, businesses in the fields of agriculture and hydraulic fracturing have been largely exempt. Brown's unwillingness to take on these large corporate water wasters lends a sharp political element to an otherwise natural disaster. There's another region of the world, however, where access to water isn't just decided on the whims of politicians dealing with natural disasters. In fact, the very existence of water crisis is official state policy with one country, Israel. Despite its location in a region thought to be perennially dry, the Holy Land actually has ample natural freshwater resources, namely in the form of underground aquifers in the Jordan River. Palestinians in the West Bank and Israel settlers live in roughly equal proximity to these resources, which theoretically would allow for equal consumption. Israeli water policy, however, has made this prospect virtually impossible. In fact, there's a shocking disparity. A report from the United Nations found that the average Israeli settler consumes 300 liters of water per day, a figure surpassing even the average Californian's 290. But thanks to Israel's military action and legal restrictions on access, the average Palestinian in the occupied West Bank gets only about 70. And for tens of thousands of Palestinians who live off the water grid altogether, daily consumption hovers around 30. That's just 10% of the Israeli figure. Both figures are well below the minimum 100 liters per day recommended by the World Health Organization. And while Israelis are watering their lawns and swimming in Olympic-sized pools, Palestinians a few kilometers away are literally dying of thirst. This inequality has deep roots, and it's no accident. Almost immediately after the creation of Israel in 1948, the fledgling country took comprehensive action to secure control of the region's water. These policies were ramped up again following the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, when Israel first assumed control of the Palestinian territories. That year, the Israeli Armed Forces issued Military Order 92, an initiative that put Palestinian water resources under Israel's military jurisdiction. This was shortly followed by Military Order 158, which required Palestinians to obtain permits from the military in order to build new water infrastructure. If they built new wells, springs, or even rain-collecting containers without Israeli permission, soldiers would confiscate or destroy them, often without prior notification. These orders, among others, remain on the books to this day. They form the basis for the administration of water access to nearly 4.4 million Palestinians. Although control over water resources is now officially the domain of Mekarot, Israel's national water company, Israeli forces routinely perform operations with the explicit intent of destroying Palestinian water infrastructure. decades of peace negotiations have done little to grant Palestinians sovereign control over their resources. Even after the Oslo Accords of the early 1990s, which were supposed to grant the Palestinians some semblance of political agency in the territories, water access remains limited. In fact, the accord simply codified the unfair distribution of water in the region, imbuing these flagrantly harmful practices with a veneer of legality. Even in Palestinian administered portions of the West Bank, Israeli troops regularly demolish rain cisterns, pipelines, agricultural water structures. The Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq has meticulously documented a number of these instances, compiling them in a report examining the extent of the hardships these operations caused to West Bank residents. One case study detailed the destruction of a farmer's well in a village east of Jenin. His well, along with five others in the area, were destroyed by the military under the pretext that it was built without proper authorization by Israel, despite the fact that an Israeli permit is not needed in the Palestinian-administered Area B of the West Bank, where these villages are located. Now, these operations showcase the coordination between civil and military channels to restrict Palestinian access to water, a system that's been startlingly effective in its goal. Even when Palestinians attempt to go through the proper Israeli channels, they're met with innumerable obstacles. Two regulatory organizations, the Joint Water Commission and the Israeli Civil Administration, have created a bureaucratic nightmare for West Bank residents attempting to acquire permits to either build new installations or repair the region's floundering infrastructure. Both organizations are capable of vetoing petitions without explanation, creating a system that prevents Palestinians from maintaining consistent and comprehensive water access. Meanwhile, access is severely curtailed even where Palestinians have permission to pump water. The most striking inequality lies in the division of the mountain aquifer, the only underground aquifer that Palestinians in the West Bank are allowed to access. Despite being the sole source for the entire territory, Palestinian extraction is limited to 20% of the aquifer's total capacity. Israel, on the other hand, has access to 80% of the aquifer's water. A stunning unequal distribution, considering it also has unfettered access to the region's remaining aquifers in the Jordan River. California's drought has captivated U.S. audiences, sparking concerns and calls to actions to prevent ecological disaster in the face of natural causes. On the subject of Israel's deliberate drought, however, media attention has been virtually non-existent. This crisis has become the norm for Palestinians for decades now, though its severity continues to increase as water becomes more scarce. End quote. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break. Come back. Please stay with us.
A man to do, oh baby. I'll sacrifice for you, I'll even do wrong for you, oh baby. Every minute, every hour, I'm gonna shower you.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'd like to say hello to my guest from Illinois, Professor Francis Boyle. He's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois Law School with a long career as an anti-war activist and upholder of human rights. He has served as the counselor for Bosnia and Herzegovina and was a legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation during the Middle East peace negotiations from 1991 to 93. He has also served on the board of directors of Amnesty International and the Council for Responsible Genetics. And he drafted the legislation for what became the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, which was signed into law by the first Bush administration. And he has been a strong opponent of the current Afghan and Iraqi wars and was an advocate for bringing international arrest warrants against George W. Bush, Cheney, and others in the Bush administration. He's published numerous papers in law reviews and many books. His most recent publications are Palestine, Palestinians, and International, and Biowarfare and Terrorism, as well as The Criminality of Nuclear Deterrence. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Gary, very much for having me on today. But before we get to the topic we agreed upon, I just wanted to affirm what you were saying earlier about water on the West Bank. I teach this subject, the laws of war. And under the laws of war and the Hague Regulation, all those aquifers belong to the Palestinians, and Israel is just outright stealing all that Palestinian water. Israel is a belligerent occupying force of the West Bank. The only water they are entitled to under the laws of war are those quantities of water necessary to support their military occupation forces. Everything else taken for settlers is just a war crime. It's that simple.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. Recently, the Pentagon completed and published its new Laws of War manual. However, I've heard the Department of Defense has removed it from the Internet. Nevertheless, as I understand it, this is a manual for high-ranking military officers to guide them on what is permitted and not permitted in armed conflict. The last such manual, the U.S. Army Field Manual, outlined the government's policies regarding war. It was written back in 1956, less than a decade after World War II and the Nuremberg trials. So basically, for the past 60 years, and after numerous wars and military engagements, the U.S. has been directly or indirectly involved around the globe. It has followed as well as broken a rule of war created a long time ago. And military technology and weapons have changed dramatically over the decades. Unarmed drones are just one. So we speak of war on terrorism, yet terrorism doesn't follow any rules of engagement. And how an enemy is defined, whether as a national army or a ragtag group of religious fundamentalists in the mountains of Afghanistan or in Montana, for that matter, has also changed. And now we find changes in the Pentagon's new Law of War manual that is, to me at least, deeply disturbing. I have not heard anything in the media about this. There are a few major topics I'd like you to discuss, please. First is the change that permits the United States forces to massacre or slaughter civilian populations if it serves the U.S.'s objective and interest. Your analysis of this new policy, because wasn't this something in the past that the U.S. generals and military officers tried to avoid by any means possible until recent times?
Right, Gary, this is a very important topic. I have given some interviews on it, but basically suppressed in the mainstream news media. There is a long history here. I'll try to encapsulate it as best I can. The man who drafted U.S. Army Field Manual 2710 of 1956 was my teacher of the laws of war at Harvard Law School, Richard R. Baxter. He was the world's leading expert on the laws of war, later elected to the International Court of Justice, a judge. And I was his top student while there on the laws of war. He supported me for this job. When Professor Baxter drew up this manual in 1956, as you correctly pointed out, it was a fair and accurate statement of the laws of war, including directly incorporated in there the Nuremberg Charter, Judgment, and Principles, as well as precedents from the prosecution of the Japanese war criminals that we also did. And taking Mr. Justice Jackson, the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, seriously, that we were not establishing one standard to be applied to the enemy, but also to be applied to ourselves. What happened was that that was fine. It was a different era. Along came the Vietnam War, and I won't go through the whole history here. There's a lot of literature on the Vietnam War. We proceeded to commit war crimes as defined by U.S. Army Field Manual 2710. That, by the way, is still valid and binding today. It has not been revoked by the Pentagon. So when that happened, of course, Judge Baxter, you know, was sort of getting out of the picture. Once he went on the World Court, he really couldn't do anything more about it, although he did negotiate Geneva Protocols 1 and 2 to the four Geneva Conventions when I was his student. But it turned out that if you looked at our conduct in the Vietnam War, and U.S. Army Field Manual 27-10, it didn't add up, it didn't square up, and indeed we were committing massive war crimes. So as time went on, 27-10, 1956, became an embarrassment to the Pentagon. And indeed, once I became a law professor myself here in 1978 with the support of Professor Baxter, I began to use that field manual against them in both civil lawsuits, criminal lawsuits, and U.S. military court-martial proceedings. So a decision was made that basically they had to get rid of 2710 and come up with a replacement. The fellow in charge of this, I know personally, his name is Hayes Parks. He was a judge advocate, general military lawyer. I think we met in about 1979. A run-of-the-mill JAG lawyer, certainly not of the stature of Professor Baxter. He was put in charge of this project by the Pentagon, I would say at least 15 years ago. And the objective of that manual, the new manual, was basically to justify retroactively and prospectively every violation of the laws of war that the United States government has committed from the Vietnam War up to and including today. For example, to give you an example, the new field manual, the new laws of war manual says use of herbicides are just fine. Well, that was put in there to retroactively justify our use of Agent Orange in Vietnam. And I'm sure all your listeners are aware of the terrible effects that Agent Orange had, both on our own veterans and millions of Vietnamese who still have not been paid by the United States, and the chemical companies have not been paid. But clearly the use of Agent Orange and the way they used it was a war crime and a crime against humanity. Now, that is the agenda behind the new manual. In addition, Hayes Parks and I, well, we were on many panels together, but we literally locked horns in the court-martial proceedings against Captain Lawrence Rockwood, who was trying to stop torture in Haiti at the Port-au-Prince prison by the Cedras thugs that we still left in power, and despite the fact they were surrounded by 20,000 U.S. troops, and we refused to stop the torture. So Captain Rockwood went in there to try to stop the torture, and the military prosecuted him, subjected him to court-martial. He was facing 10 years in Fort Leavenworth for this. And their expert on the laws of war in support of torture was Hayes Parks. He was there. I was there. Ramsey Clark and I helped defend Captain Rockwood, and we got him off. Between you and me, it was a minor miracle. You can read my book, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law, and see how we got Captain Rockwood off. But the bottom line is the guy who put this together, one, mediocre, and then two, a torture monger and justifier. So that is the background here to this manual. In addition, then, Gary, shortly after it came out, I began to read it. I'm on a law professor's list specializing in this area, and I proceeded to demolish it line by line on this law professor's list for the first, first section, about 80 pages. One of our members used to work for the Reagan administration, and he brought my criticisms to the attention of Hayes Parks, the principal author and organizer, And Parks responded that the whole manual had been politicized, and he disavowed all responsibility for it. So at that point, I decided, fine, there's no point my continuing through the next 1,100 pages of this thing, although I did also go through the they had a documentary supplement commenting on laws of war treaties. When the principal author and organizer had already repudiated the darn thing. So that is really, Gary, what I would say, the politics, the sociology behind this manual. It is extremely dangerous, Gary. It's not just military commanders being guided by this manual. But what we have all military commanders around the world, and that's, you know, even goes down to, I guess, you know, probably a lieutenant, have JAG lawyers advising them on questions and matters of international law. So before a commander, for example, will use military force of a certain type or an interrogation, launch an attack, he will ask his JAG lawyer for an opinion as to its legality under the laws of war. Well, what will happen now, instead of going back to the field manual of 1956, they will go to this new field manual, and the JAG lawyer will then advise the commander, oh, sure, you can go right ahead and blow this up and kill these people and torture them, et cetera. So it's truly horrendous, the consequences that this will lead to in the future. There are two things that your listeners can do to stop this. First, the United States Constitution in Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress has the constitutional power to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces of the United States of America. Therefore, you must tell your member of Congress, either in the House or the Senate, to introduce a resolution into either the House or Senate that revokes this manual, because it is still out there and it is still being used. Maybe it has been pulled off the public website, you know, but the Pentagon has its own websites. Second, you have to communicate directly with President Obama. He is Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces. President Obama has the authority to revoke this manual if he wants to under the Constitution. President Obama was behind me at Harvard Law School. He knows of my expertise in this area. And you can certainly use my name in your communications to President Obama that this manual reduces us to the level of Nazis. There's no other word for it. Now, we could go through all the rest of it. For example, reporters. Red Cross manual on the Geneva Convention clearly says, quote, journalists engaged in dangerous professional missions in areas of armed conflict shall be considered as civilians and protected as such. Now, that's the black letter rule of international law and the laws of war. And yet now you'll note that all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the law of war manual has decided to treat journalists as unprivileged combatants. And regretfully, there's been some misinterpretation of what that means in the news media. I noticed the New York Times condemned it. An unprivileged combatant is even worse than a spy. Under the laws of war, if, for example, a military commander in the field were to conclude a journalist, say a U.S. journalist or a foreign journalist, were a spy, the journalist would be apprehended and then entitled to a legal proceeding to determine his or her status, were they a spy or not. But as an unprivileged combatant, the commander can just shoot the journalist dead. And we saw instances of this happening in the Iraq War by Bush Jr., where they directly targeted journalists and killed some. Likewise, on killing civilians under the laws of war. Indeed, you know, Professor Baxter taught us this. Under no circumstances can armed forces directly target civilians. It doesn't matter. It's clearly a war crime. If you read the current law of war manuals, they're justifying warfare with nuclear weapons. Well, the International Court of Justice has an advisory opinion on the threat and use of nuclear weapons. The United States government appeared, made all its arguments. They are rejected by the world court. I could go on, you know, if you want, on the list of atrocities that this manual is not only trying to justify retroactively, but prospectively as well. And that's the danger here.
Well, you've made a lot of important points, and you've made the important ones. I would just finally say that the new concerns are weapons are permissible, including landmines, nuclear weapons, depleted uranium, herbicides, napalm, cluster bombs, and expanding bullets. Plus, as you said, journalists can now be determined as unprivileged belligerents. And in the past, we saw how Chris Hedges and several colleagues filed an unsuccessful lawsuit against Obama over the National Defense Authorization Act's language that would equate journalists opposed to U.S. policies as terrorists. So clearly, this is meant to do harm and give it power. And it's such an unbridled extension of anything that's happened before. And I'm just very pleased that you're there, Professor Francis Boyle, to give voice to these concerns. And let us hope that with the many people listening to this program and the sharing of this program, word will get out to other people as well. So thank you very much for being on.
Gary, it's not hope. Everyone is going to have to tell their member of the House of Representatives and their senators to introduce a bill to revoke this law of war manual, which Congress can do. And then everyone must directly tell President Obama to revoke this manual pursuant to his powers as Commander-in-Chief of Armed Forces. That's what we have
okay.
to do here.
We will work on this diligently because there's so much at risk if we don't. Thank you very much. We appreciate being
thank
on
you,
today.
Gary. Yeah.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.